How do you solve a problem like the Strait of Hormuz? The war with Iran seems over, but this crucial oil choke point seems set to remain closed potentially for months now. Can America get the oil flowing again quickly? As the crisis drags on, is China backing Iran more firmly? Also, the EU took some important, practical, less flashy steps towards becoming a superstate this week. We're going to look at all of this and more on today's Trumpet World. To start, I think we have to give our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic, his moment in the sun. While we were recording last week, Iran and President Trump both came out and announced the straits are completely open. President Trump put on his Truth Social, they're open, never to be closed again. Oil crashed back down to earth and came well under $100 a barrel. Stock markets soared to their highest levels ever. For investors, pundits around the world, this was it. Ceasefire, now Hormuz was open, war was over, economy could go back to normal. We're sitting down a week later. That barely lasted, that didn't even last 24 hours, and the strait is still closed. That is what Mr. Zekic said would happen while we were talking to him last week. He was the Jeremiah, or the sounded the note of caution that we'd seen things like this before. So, Mihailo, what happened? Why didn't this all just open up?
Well, the big factor in this is who exactly said the strait was opening. The announcement came from Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, who was the main figure the United States was negotiating with in Pakistan. You might think, okay, the foreign minister in most countries is directly under the government in charge of putting all of these in charge of a country's diplomatic policy. He speaks with authority. He wouldn't say anything that would contradict the guy in charge. The big issue with Iran, though, is that, in a sense, nobody is really in charge in Iran. And in Araghchi's case, him and the civilian government are not the main power behind the throne in Iran. The main power behind the throne, as we've been getting reports constantly, is actually the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or the IRGC, Iran's main military. Axios had a story right after everything blew up in Hormuz, quoting anonymous American sources. And here's a few quotes from them. "We thought they were negotiating with the right people, but what happened is the Iranian team went back and the IRGC and those kinds of people said, 'Oh, no, no, you don't speak for us.' Another said, 'We aren't sure who's in charge and neither do they. That's going to have to work itself out.'" And the big implication is that everything Araghchi and President Pezeshkian and all of the civilian figures, what they were talking about in Iran or what they were talking about in Pakistan, was not actually with the approval of the military. Now, one could say, okay, the military didn't like this, but the military is not in charge in and of itself in most countries. They shouldn't have a say on this. Well, the New York Times reported yesterday that Iran's new supreme leader, Mojtaba Khamenei, the son of the late Ayatollah, he's in hospital right now in really critical condition. He's expected to get a prosthetic leg at some point. He may have to get plastic surgery on his face. It's painful for him to speak. And between that and the fact that he hasn't been in a senior position of leadership before this, he actually isn't doing much of the running of the country. And according to the Times reports and its sources, that he's letting the generals of the IRGC do whatever they want. One Iranian source that the New York Times spoke to said, quote, "Mojtaba is managing the country as though he is the director of the board. He relies heavily on the advice and guidance of the board members, and they collectively make all the decisions. The generals are the board members," end quote. And even if you think about all the bombing campaigns that was leading up to this, all of the different high-profile figures that have been assassinated by Israel, by the United States, the IRGC is basically the one institution in the country with any significant level of power that, okay, they've had a few people taken out, but in general, the command structure is still there intact and functioning. The civilian government, as I mentioned, that still exists. The president still exists, but that was put in basically to give a veneer for the Ayatollah's policies, and they don't really have much power outside of the Ayatollah himself. In this case, the new Ayatollah doesn't want the civilian government having most of the authority. He's relying on the IRGC, which is where his power base used to be. And while President Trump, while members of his administration could talk to people like Araghchi, the civilian government, as much as they want, you can't really make a ceasefire if you're not talking to the people that actually control the levers of power.
So that sounds like this is quite a solvable problem then. Talk to the wrong person last week, but there's still a person to talk to. It's the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. Donald Trump just needs to talk to the right person this weekend, and we can have the Strait open on Monday.
Well, if they wanted to, if they agreed with the idea of the Strait opening in and of itself, Iran actually has two different militaries. There's the IRGC and then the conventional military. The IRGC, it's separate from the conventional military because it has an ideological foundation. You could almost consider them analogous to the SS in Nazi Germany. Okay, there was the Wehrmacht, the regular military, and then there was this completely separate organization that fought in the same wars, but had a completely different structure and was underpinned by ideological visions and would do things that the normal military would never have considered doing because of their ideological vision. That's the IRGC. They were founded specifically to protect the Islamic Revolution at home and spread the revolution in the world of infidels outside the borders. Signing a piece of paper, letting everything get normalized with the United States, the Great Satan, is completely the opposite of what they stand for and the complete opposite of the beliefs of anybody that decides to join the IRGC, the rank-and-file soldiers up to the generals now running the country. If they wanted peace, they would have just sided with the civilian government, but it's very clear they do not want peace.
I was going to ask you, so what comes, like, how does Donald Trump open the strait? But I guess that is exactly the question now that the Pentagon and that others are grappling with. To force it open, you pretty much need boots on the ground. Not necessarily a total occupation of all of Iran, the way that you had to say Nazi Germany or Japan just to open the straits. But there's enough cheap missile launch sites and fast patrol boat sites and enough coastline that you're talking a very significant ground presence around the coast of Hormuz to open it by force. And then to open it by talks, by diplomacy, I guess with the IRGC, they would only accept maybe not quite an American surrender, but certainly Donald Trump giving up a whole lot of the goals that he went to war with in the first place.
Exactly. And their goals, I mean, they know they're not going to completely vanquish the American superpower at this stage, but they do know that the worse they can make America look, the worse they can make President Trump look, the more likely it is that America is never going to attempt anything like this again, and that Iran will, like a phoenix coming out of the ashes, a renewed reputation through the Middle East, throughout the rest of the world, saying, look, we stand it up to America, and as much as we could, we won. For President Trump's part, technically the ceasefire that is ongoing right now was supposed to expire on Tuesday, and then he opened it up indefinitely. He first said he was going to give Iran a few days to figure out how the government is going to come together and present a unified position. And then he just said, well, there's no time limit. And from America's perspective, not only is boots on the ground unpopular, but even if the bombing campaign itself was resumed, America, some estimates have suggested the United States has used up about half of its Patriot missiles just in this one conflict alone. That's considered one of the most powerful weapons in America's arsenal, and they've already depleted half their stock. That can't be replicated overnight. The U.S. is in, and then the, And then, of course, there's also the questions of the legalities of this war and not going to Congress, even though there wasn't an imminent threat to the United States itself. And the war itself is getting more and more unpopular with Congress. And will they try and hamstring the president's efforts? Well, and in a midterm year, no less. So physically, the United States, and specifically President Trump, do not really have any good options in this. And it looks like they're trying to save face as much as possible. And the IRGC realizes if we keep dragging this on, if we don't let them save face, then that's going to help our position out immensely.
I mean, to Donald Trump's credit, he's not signed a bad deal to get the straits open so far. But it does seem like we've reached this impasse now where the only deals on offer from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps are bad deals. So that's the option. You sign a bad deal or open the fight back up, try and force them to accept a lesser deal. And for now, President Trump has kind of chosen the third option of just not doing anything, of waiting. I mean, you mentioned some of the conditions that the IRGC might be willing to accept. Like the bad deal options, the consequences are quite far reaching. Another point thing that they would love to have is a toll booth on the Strait of Hormuz. And I mean, we met referenced this on the show before, where if you gave them what they're asking for right now, which admittedly, what comes out of a negotiation might not be what they're asking for right now. Maybe it would be a compromise where they have a toll booth, but not charging the rate that they want. But still, the one that they're looking at charging right now, the revenue they would be getting from that alone would be triple their annual budget. Like gargantuan sums of money for Iran that they could unlock here. And the implications of that are pretty far reaching. Indonesia this week, they started talking about, well, actually, we've been inspired by what the mullahs are doing. We'd like to start charging a toll on anybody using the Strait of Malacca. And even more important in terms of shipping volume, Strait than Hormuz. I mean, this sets a if countries around the world can start charging for their choke points, globalization, free trade breaks down very quickly. And yeah, there's some advantages of globalization and breaking down, but we only have the living standards that we have because of free trade. So, or I shouldn't say free trade because that's referring to no tariffs, but the ability to traverse the oceans cheaply and safely. So there are global consequences to this, and the consequences of just giving into Iran and opening up the strait are a lot big. Like, you know, okay, that might immediately lower the price at the pump, but it could have some massive long-range economic consequences, consequences for America's power and prestige. I mean, this is really sending the message that America can pound you, but if you can stick around a bit, you can get away with defying the United States, depending on what that deal looks like. So all along, we've been analyzing this from Bible prophecy. And like we emphasized a couple of weeks ago, really what you're seeing here is a massive amount of fulfilled prophecy, where people thought Iran was finished after the first 24 hours. And we were saying, well, no, we've identified, or Trump editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, he's identified Iran as the King of the South. And you know, the evidence for that is in his book, The King of the South. That's the title of the book. And you could go and prove and read that for yourself. And so, yeah, having seen that, proved that, we were saying, well, Iran is not going to be completely wiped out here. They're going to keep at least some element of power because they're going to grow in power. They're ultimately going to push at Europe, and Europe is the one that's going to take care of them and obliterate this radical Islamic King of the South. We're a long way towards that happening now. You know, Iran has very clearly survived the war, and it's very clear that America is not going to be the one that deals with this Iranian problem. And it's very clear that Iran is not cowed. They're not going to stop their pushy behavior. And Daniel 11 and verse 40 talks about Iran pushing, and this time they push at a European king of the north. So we've got fulfilled prophecy already really happening here. So, Mihailo, beyond that, what do the events of this week tell us about that fulfilled prophecy?
So much of what we expect Iran to do in the future, based off Bible prophecy, Iran has been going through that trend, you could say, being pushy, being provocative, leading the radical Islamist world. But there are a few key details that have yet to be fulfilled that have gotten at least us at the Trumpet speculating that there could be a leadership change from Ali Khamenei, the previous supreme leader. As one of those, if you look at verses 42 and 43, it talks about countries like Egypt, Libya, Ethiopia being part of Iran's proxy empire, all in Africa. Iran is famous for its proxy empire. Africa really isn't part of the equation at this point, at least significantly. And to this point, the great Satan is the United States. The little Satan is the state of Israel. Europe really isn't on Iran's radar, except as they make themselves obvious targets through letting migrants in and not vetting who's coming in for things like terror attacks, etc. But Europe is not the main target at this point. But Khamenei, for his part, he was willing to bide his time, and he had maybe different priorities on where to focus Iran's energies than some of these other people. If you have the IRGC ruling Iran, a lot of those people, they would probably be ready and willing to light the fuse, so to speak, and have everything blow up immediately, which would explain getting into different territories that the previous government wasn't focused on, which would explain finding new enemies that at this point weren't really big enemies to cause problems with. And we don't know exactly if Mujtaba Khamenei may succumb to his wounds and there may be a new guy coming in. We don't know the exact twists and turns, what's going to happen. But the idea of this radical state within a state becoming the state itself, even more radical than most other elements of Iranian society, is definitely in line with the image that Daniel 11 pictures.
Now, while this has all been going on, we've also had the Lebanese ceasefire that's kind of continued in parallel with the Iran ceasefire. And in fact, it was Israel and Lebanon signing a ceasefire that prompted the declaration from the Iranian foreign ministry last week that they would open up Hormuz, that they were trying to link their ceasefire to what was happening in Lebanon. Can you update on the situation there, Mihailo?
Yes, well, like any ceasefire in the Middle East, it's not absolute. There have been skirmishes between Israel and Hezbollah since then. But the most significant aspects of it, well, today we just heard the ceasefire has been extended for 3 weeks. Technically, this is a ceasefire between Israel and the Lebanese government. Hezbollah was not a party to the conversations, although they've let the Lebanese government speak on their behalf. The Israeli foreign minister made an interesting statement that once Hezbollah is out of the way, there are no major quarrels between Israel and Lebanon. There may be a few border disputes and stuff, but nothing that can't be ironed out in negotiations. And they're very optimistic that they may even have a peace agreement with Lebanon and direct talks between the two countries, highest level in decades, are still set to happen. Parallel prophecy with Daniel 11 is Psalm 83, which the King of the South again can elaborate, which speaks of another Middle Eastern alliance formed against Iran, but also against Israel. And Lebanon, verse 7 of Psalm 83, mentions Gebel and Tyre, two cities in ancient Lebanon that still exist as cities today, as being part of this alliance. And even though Lebanon, through Hezbollah, has been arguably Iran's most important proxy for years, because of this prophecy, Mr. Fleury has said that one way or another, Lebanon is going to break its alliance with Iran. And to see how weak Hezbollah is, and they are definitely, like the IRGC, a faction that would love to go do or die, guns blazing, let's finish off Israel, we'll never make peace. The fact that they're this weak right now, and the fact that the Lebanese government is sending so many olive branches to Israel, suggests that this transformation of Lebanon, it's been partly fulfilled before with Hezbollah's eviction, but it isn't complete yet. This could happen very, very soon. And the implication from Psalm 83 is also that Israel and the United States and the British nations are unaware of these countries' hostility. they're unaware of the real purpose of this alliance, and they may actually have a false sense of security because of this alliance. And the fact that we're seeing Israel and Lebanon get close like this is reflective of this. Last year, I wrote an article called "Will Lebanon Make Peace with the Jews?" which has obviously earlier stories, but is still part of the same general trend that can fill in more. We could put a link to that in the show notes.
And I think another thing that you've talked about before that you see with this Lebanese ceasefire is we did feel like we got a bit of a glimpse at the potential divide between Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump. I mean, you mentioned this on the show on Friday, that the way that Israel had kind of been bounced into this, Donald Trump was announcing this even while Benjamin Netanyahu was kind of giving his cabinet the initial briefings or trying to hold a discussion about this. But then he went on to post on Truth Social that Israel was forbidden from bombing Lebanon, which went beyond the text of what the ceasefire still gave Israel the right to deal with Hezbollah within Lebanon. That was probably the most dramatic sign that we have seen yet, or the most dramatic disagreement we've ever seen between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, I think certainly at least during Donald Trump's second term in office, where he's kind of smacking Israel down like that and saying, you shall not bomb. Now, business as usual has kind of continued. It doesn't really look like Israel has changed anything as the result of that, and there hasn't been any consequences from Donald Trump. But at the same time, do you think we are getting a look at this relationship breaking down, or the cracks that have been perhaps hidden behind closed doors in this relationship?
Well, I think it has to do mainly with a divergence of interests. For Israel, these wars are existential. For the United States, especially for a president who came to office on the platform of ending the forever wars, and many of his critics have called him out on that since then, these wars are becoming more of a liability to him politically than anything. And I'm glad you tied that in, because there was one other aspect of this general trend of the United States not finishing the job, trying to save face, get out as comfortably as possible, that I want to mention. In Mr. Fleury's book, The King of the South, he writes about how we're expecting Europe to come in and finish all these jobs. The United States isn't even mentioned in this prophecy. And this is what he writes, quote, "Think seriously about the fact that this will not occur, this conquest, at the hands of America or Britain. These nations aren't even involved in this prophesied war. That is because they are going to fall into social and economic ruin before this prophecy is even fulfilled. The time when Britain and America were superpowers or kings is history." And then a little further down, he writes, "It takes one king to topple another king." You think about how much pride America has with, we have the most powerful military in the world, nobody can stand up to us, we have the most sophisticated technology in the world. You've written about America's over-reliance on technology. And a six-week war with a country that's not even a superpower like Iran, and America's already used up half of its, one of its most powerful military arsenals, and it couldn't even win the war. I think that in and of itself is telling on how fragile America, the perception of America's military dominance is. And America's starting to wake up to it, and the rest of the world is starting to wake up to it as well. These kinds of wars, you go back to the days of even the Korean War or the Vietnam War, where they were much bigger. Even if America didn't win those wars, at least they would have had much bigger of a show of force and a much more demonstration of their power. In this case, we don't even have that. Not saying that that's what America should do, but I think it is a telling sign on just how far America's global power has gotten with here, or with Iran, and with what's going on in Lebanon as well.
And that ties in with Israel looking to Europe for help instead of the United States. That relationship has broken down at that point, and you have a lot of questions about America's willingness or ability to help Israel, and they end up turning to Germany. Germany responds by coming and taking care of Iran, taking Iran out. But then after that, they turn on Israel in the Middle East and the United States as well. There is one more story I thought I'd just mention quickly before we move on from the Middle East that is worth noting. And Mr. Stephen Flurry's talked about this quite a bit early on this week on the Trumpet Daily Show. And that is that Israel will soon be having a so-called pride celebration on the shores of the Dead Sea, literally in the area where the ancient city of Sodom stood. They are now celebrating perversion on the site of Sodom. So the Pride Land Festival, it's going to begin on June 1st. They're going to have 15 hotels and beach complexes, parties going around the clock, millions of dollars spent on hotels, building this temporary city in the desert from scratch. They've got a dedicated space for family and children at this, I mean, they call it LGBTQ. It's a perversion celebration. And again, this is on Sodom. This is on the site that God wiped out because of this sin. Isaiah 3 and verse 9, God there talks about what they declare their sin as Sodom. They hide it not. They're proud of this and displaying it in just this incredibly bold, proud way. And this isn't really to do with the Middle East. We got a story from the UK that shows us why, in part, God responds so powerfully to this sin, how destructive this is, where you have two homosexual men appearing in court in here in England, where they adopted a 9-year-old boy named Preston Davey. And you know, the adoption panel gave it to these men because the adoption panel was woke and going along with the values of today. And less than 4 months later, the baby was dead, subject to incredible sexual, physical abuse. He suffered at least 40 traumatic injuries during his time in the defendant's care, the Telegraph wrote. 30 external bruises. There was internal bruising to his mouth and throat, internal bruising to his bottom, bowel, and bladder, lacerations to his rectum, and a fractured arm. He suffered horribly at the hands of these two men. And as Mr. Hilliker wrote in his morning brief about this, the adoption agency, the government panel, they should be criminally liable for this. And God holds them liable for this. That is why God responded the way that he did to Sodom. This is where this perversion leads. And this is, homosexuality is a perversion, and it leads to those that engage in it, they're on the path to worse perversions, pedophilia and worse crimes. There's a whole lot of stats on this. Homosexual men, about 3% of the population, commit 30 to 40% of the sex crimes against children. And there were a host of studies in the early 90s about this, and it showing how the massive correlation between homosexuality and child abuse. And then they all got shut down. And so now you'll have the experts will come out and say, well, there's no credible studies or high quality studies into that demonstrate a link between homosexuality and child abuse. And it's a bit of an exaggeration, but it's kind of right, because high quality studies are expensive. And often what university departments will do, if they're going to spend a lot of money in the studies, they do a preliminary study. So they did some of these preliminary studies. They all point to this massive correlation, this massive problem within the so-called LGBT community. And so, of course, there's no funding there to do a bigger study. No way are they going to allow a bigger study to happen. And by refusing to allow these bigger studies, then they can trot the experts out and say, oh, no, but there's not been a mass study that's shown this. And it's lying with statistics. And there was the New Family Structure study in 2012, for example, that found that people that grew up with a homosexual father, 31% said they were forced to have sex against their will at some point in their lives. 24% became suicidal. It was a horrible situation for those people. People with lesbian mothers, 23% said they were touched sexually by a parent or caregiver. And again, this is one of the few kind of big studies on this. So people have tried to discredit this. And yeah, the sample sizes are pretty small. You've got 15,000 people. But of that 15,000 people, only a very small percentage of those 15,000 were brought up by a homosexual parent and were adults in 2012. Doesn't disprove it, but it is enough to show, well, we know what a bigger study will find, and they refuse to allow them. So, I mean, that's taken us a bit outside the Middle East, but I thought it's worth noting this really brazen declaration of sin going on in Israel. And, you know, Israel has, the state of Israel in the Middle East, it has allowed a whole lot of perversion, and God will correct them for that. And that's why these attacks are happening. You know, that's why they're not being protected. That's why they're going to experience this captivity. And this is the only way that God can break through to people that are just so proud of their sin. Well, before we quite completely move on to the Middle East, we'll come back to the Iran war, the Iran situation. We've been bringing Andrew in secondarily to talk about it for the last few weeks. I think a little bit like Donald Trump, Andrew Miller, our US correspondent, is getting a little bit tired of the Iran war and ready to move on to other topics. But Asia, and particularly China, is still very involved in what is going on. So this time, we'll bring in Jeremiah Jacques to get a look at China's involvement with Iran and their even potential backing of Iran.
Yes, that's right. I wanted to talk about China increasing its intelligence sharing with Iran and its defense-related transfers to Iran, which has been making a difference in undercutting U.S. and Israeli objectives, and it's giving Iran greater military and diplomatic leverage. So this is based on a new report by the Australian Strategic Policy Institute that was published on Wednesday, and it talks about how China, very much like Russia, has kind of an overarching goal of just making the United States bleed in any way it can. And so that overarching motivation prompts China and Russia to ally with all kinds of bad actors that they have nothing ideologically in common with, except for a hatred of the United States and the global order. So that's really why China and Iran have been bedfellows for decades now. And in the context of the current war, this report shows that China has given Iran a commercial reconnaissance satellite, and it has also given Iran access to Chinese satellite data, including imagery with AI tagging of U.S. military sites. And that has significantly enhanced Iran's intelligence capabilities, and it has enabled some very precise targeting of American assets in the region. China has also helped Iran with its drone program and has supplied Iran with chemical precursors such as sodium perchlorate, which are used in solid fuel ballistic missile production. And there are even indications that China is now planning to soon deliver anti-ship cruise missiles to Iran as well. So here we see China aiding Iran in some significant ways, and this has helped Iran's regime to weather these attacks and to exert kind of an outsized force during the war. And it helps Iran's regime to remain very dangerous, even though it has been weakened. It also strengthens Iran's hand in negotiations. You know, both China and Russia have helped Iran to avoid having to negotiate from a position of total weakness. In a ceasefire, such as the one that we're currently in the midst of, that's very significant. U.S. strategy is now far more complicated than it otherwise would be because Iran is not isolated. It's backed by two of the world's most powerful militaries, Russia and China. And this means that Iran is harder to degrade over time. So the big picture is just that the backing of China and Russia means that the cost of finishing the job for the United States, if America ever mustered the will to finish the job, it would be higher. So this, you know, this ceasefire, as this ceasefire continues, we don't know exactly what's in store, but we can be sure that whatever happens, and whether it's due to Chinese and Russian backing or other factors, biblical prophecy shows that this war on Iran will not end with the annihilation of Iran's radical Islamic regime. And we have an article that takes a close look at those specific Bible prophecies. It's by Trumpet senior editor Joel Hilliker. It's called Prophesying Iran's Rise and Fall. So for anyone who would like to understand why Iran's regime will not be defeated, as disheartening as that may be to hear, I hope you'll check out that article once again, Prophesying Iran's Rise and Fall.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. I guess there are ways that China has benefited directly from this war and could even continue to benefit if it kicks off again. I mean, the big thing that they haven't benefited from, obviously, is the Strait of Hormuz being closed. But they've also planned and stockpiled oil and prepared for that kind of scenario. But we have seen, like Mihailo mentioned, half of America's Patriot missile stocks being depleted and then key resources being redeployed from the Pacific theater. I think particularly there were missiles from South Korea, naval assets pulled out of the Pacific to deal with Iran. I mean, I've seen some commentators even speculate that China could accelerate their timetable for invading Taiwan to take advantage of that drawdown. Do you think that kind of thing is likely?
I think that all of those developments that you just mentioned there are certainly very much welcome by China, particularly the drawdown of the THAAD missile defense system there from the Korean Peninsula. And it could well be that the Chinese will say, right now we have a window that is quite rare, and we need to take advantage of this time to pounce on Taiwan, because the U.S. is in a uniquely degraded situation, at least in terms of East Asia right now. So who knows? This could be something that could prompt the Chinese to pounce.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. What else do you have for us from the Asia region?
Yes, first up, a story here about Russia and its military power. A new report by the Netherlands Military Intelligence Agency says, even after 4 years of brutal war with Ukraine, and even after years of sanctions strangling Russia's economy, its military power is now stronger than before. This report details the way Russia has strengthened its armed forces by increasing recruitment and improving training operations, and by ramping up heavy weapons production and strategic ammunition reserves. And the report warns that with all this firepower that Russia is amassing, it could soon even be starting wars with NATO nations, maybe even within a year or so. So a very sobering report, but one that does align perfectly with the Bible's prophecies about Russia making war on a much larger scale in the years ahead. And then one final story here about Japan. The Japanese have been deeply rattled by Russia's war and its increasing firepower, and also by China's increasing military power and its increasing belligerence. So the Japanese have been really pulling out all the stops to boost their own firepower. And this week we saw them pass a new law saying that they can begin selling lethal weapons to their partner nations. So Japan can now export domestically built fighter jets and warships, missiles, drones, and other advanced weaponry. So that reverses a ban that had been in place for several decades as part of Japan's post-World War II pacifist posture. And it's just one more sign that Japan has fully abandoned pacifism at this point, and that it is rapidly becoming a major global military force once again.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Now, for Europe this week, I wanted to draw attention to an important meeting happening, I guess you could say, in the general vicinity of the Middle East. And that is that the leaders of the European Union were meeting in Cyprus yesterday and today. The big theme of this meeting is basically how to replace NATO without the United States. This has been a divide that has really exploded wide open since the end of since the entire war with Iran. Europe didn't like the war. They then closed American access to even bases that America built in many places, closed their airspace, refused to be involved, refused to even allow their airspace to be used to rescue a downed pilot. And they're very quickly turning their back on that alliance. Now, they still want some kind of mutual defense clause, though. And the European Union has a mutual defense clause. Article 42.7 of the Lisbon Treaty, or the Treaty of the European Union, It makes the European Union a mutual defense alliance, just like NATO. An attack on one EU member is treated like an attack on all. But NATO's been around for 75 years now. It regularly drills together, it has a clear command structure, it has spent decades making its nuclear or its mutual defense provision as specific and as workable as possible. You know, they wanted to show to Russia, hey, we can respond quickly. So if Russia invades Estonia, everybody's on the same page of exactly this is how Estonia triggers the defense clause, this is how NATO responds, this is who does what. This is how the decisions are made. It's all really well thought through so that they can, it's very practical and implementable. Europe's Article 42.7, it was introduced in 2009. It was invoked once by France when they were subject to a terrorist attack, but nothing very much detailed followed that. It looks more symbolic than practical at the moment. So the Cypriot president who holds the rotating European presidency, he presented an early draft at this meeting as a kind of a standard of how this procedure could operate. A Cypriot official said it could be something like the activation of an EU civil protection mechanism, which allows any country hit by a disaster to request emergency assistance. So they want to be able to move forwards without NATO. Then just ahead of the meeting, the EU agreed to release a 90 billion euro loan to Ukraine after the outgoing Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban had dropped his veto of this, and it's called a loan, it's a gift. Ukraine is not required or ever really expected to pay it back. It's only expected to pay it back if Russia gives them the money at some point in the future. So it's a gift, they're calling it a loan. Anyway, what's significant about this is that the EU is once again borrowing money as a bloc, like it did during COVID. The European Union itself is issuing debt. And this ability to jointly borrow money, it's a boring but very practical part of being a super state. A lot of people will point to the decision for the United States as a whole to borrow money rather than the state of Virginia or the state of Massachusetts borrowing money as the decisive point where the United States was on the path to becoming one nation, one country, rather than a loose alliance of 13 different states. It puts you on the path of having a single treasury, a single taxation. You're something maybe more like what you have in the United States, where there's a federal tax and there's state taxes. Europe, they don't have a federal tax. They're not a super state yet. But it puts them in that direction of they're borrowing money and having to pay that money back, which, okay, that right now they're living with the fiction that Ukraine is going to pay that money back because they're going to get reparations from Russia. Once that fiction is exposed and Europe has to deal with that, we've got more pressure on a European tax, more pointing towards a finance ministry. This is what goes into a super state. If you think about this American Revolutionary War, no taxation without representation, like tax and power, money and power, they go together. The office of prime minister in the United Kingdom, they didn't sit down and say, well, we need to create a job called prime minister. It's just the first lord of the treasury, the guy who had the purse strings, was accused by his enemies of being the prime minister. He's too important. The fact that he controls the purse strings means that he really controls the country. So Europe having a joint purse, well, now you're getting on a path towards, well, who controls that purse? And that person is the de facto leader of Europe. So it's a, like I say, it's not a particularly eye-catching story, but it's a very important one. Now, also at this meeting, the EU leaders, they discussed fast-tracking EU membership, which they said is not going to happen. A few leaders poured kind of cold water on that. They offered Ukraine some kind of symbolic EU-lite membership that would sound like EU membership, but would not be EU membership and would be missing all the crucial details. They rejected that. They also approved a 20-point sanction package on Russia. And they met with the leaders of Lebanon and Syria, which gets into what we were talking about with Mihailo earlier. These are important practical steps, like I said, towards a super state. And we saw other practical steps this week as well. So the Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk this week met with Emmanuel Macron to discuss increased defense cooperation, including nuclear defense cooperation, and Poland coming potentially under France's nuclear umbrella. And what is pretty significant here is you're seeing the emergence of a kind of a core Europe. You know, European leaders, they're talking about enlarging. Nobody wants to enlarge because they can't get agreement on what they're doing anyway. There are three nations that opted out of this $90 billion bailout package for Ukraine. If they want to really move forwards, they need to move forwards as a smaller body. And you can see where you've got a real core developing in France, Germany, and Poland. These three countries that have talked about nuclear sharing. And Mr. Gerald Flurry had an article this week, a very important one that I think will have more, well, it'll be in an upcoming trumpet print, I'm sure, whether it's in the next one or further down the line, but called The First of the Ten Kings Unite Against America. And he points to this meeting of Europe's six leading economies back in January, where you have Germany, France, Italy, the Netherlands, Poland, and Spain. And he says it looks like all of them could be in the Ten Kings. You know, what we've been forecasting about Europe is all built around this Bible prophecy in Revelation chapter 17 that shows you're going to have a union of 10 kings come together. You know, it says in verse 12 and 13 of that chapter, "The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, which receive no kingdom as yet, but receive power as king 1 hour with the beast." It's because of this prophecy that Mr. Armstrong in 1945, as Germany was utterly defeated, said Germany's going to rise again and it's going to do it as a leader of a kind of European union. Because the Bible talks about a union of nations. And so he said, well, watch for there to be a union of nations. And sure enough, you had the European coal and steel community. And it developed and grew. And you've got this European union now. But it's a lot more than 10 kings in there right now, 26, 27 kings. So we're watching that to be pared down or for a smaller group to move forwards. And so having six of these people get together, well, that's very significant. Mr. Flurry said this is about the 10 kings finally coming together and uniting. The German finance minister, Lars Klebling, he said, "We are providing the impetus. Others can join us." Mr. Flurry commented, "You know, yes, we can get it going. Germany's always done that. Others can join us, but it is all about Germany leading." He said, "I believe this is the start of the fulfillment of a long-awaited prophecy. It is going to be the 10 kings. It's already starting." And then you see, like I said, Poland and France and Germany, three of these six countries getting together and talking about more concrete military cooperation, nuclear cooperation. You keep watching the rise of this European superstate that is going on right now. As the European Union splits away from the United States, turns against the United States, that trend is just feeding into and accelerating this push for a superstate. Because if America's not going to defend them, well, they need to figure out how would we defend ourselves. And that means they've got to come together and do defense cooperation. And they've got to work out, well, then where do we get the funding from? And we need to jointly borrow money so that we can have the kind of military size that we need. So the split from America is fueling as well the rise of this 10-nation superpower. So again, Mr. Flurry talks about that in his article, "The First of the Ten Kings Unites Against America." So keep watching the rise of that European power. Now, our US correspondent, Andrew Miller, is taking a week off from talking about Iran. The war has kind of dragged on for so long that there are plenty of other things going on in the United States that needs our attention. So what do you have for us from the English-speaking world this week?
Well, yeah, that's right. The war in Iran, it's still big news. And one of the big things about it is the division it's fostered between the Trump administration and the Roman Catholic Church. Divisions that are actually expressing themselves in other ways as well. Another big non-Iran-related story here in America, but still involving the Roman Catholic Church, is the ongoing migration crisis. Yale University estimated there was between 16 and 22 million illegal immigrants in the United States before Joe Biden took office. He let about another 10 million in, so it could be up to about 30 million illegal immigrants now. The Border Patrol agencies set a new goal to deport 1 million illegal immigrants a year. So it'd take about 30 years to actually get rid of everyone at that rate who's not here in the country legally. But the Trump administration, they're facing opposition from this from kind of a new sector. Traditionally, it's been the radical leftists who've been against border enforcement. Increasingly, the Roman Catholics Bishops' Conference has come out strong against border enforcement. And now the Bishops' Conference is teaming up with the National Association of Evangelicals. Now, this National Association of Evangelicals, it doesn't represent all evangelical Christians in America. It doesn't even represent a majority of evangelical Christians in America. But it does represent about 45,000 evangelical churches that represent about 4% of the United States population. So together with the Bishops' Conference, which represents about 20% of America's population, you've got about a quarter of Americans represented by these two groups. Now, they produced a new report this month, which I've brought with me. It's called One Part of the Body. And it's making some very revolutionary claims. One, it starts right off saying that, like, basically all Christians everywhere are part of the same body of Christ, something Catholics and Protestants for centuries have not liked it when you've said they're part of the same church. So this is now the National Association of Evangelicals basically publicly stating that, like, whether evangelical or Catholic, we're all Christians in the United States. And about 80% of those Donald Trump would deport also follow some version of Christianity, mostly Catholic, but a few evangelicals as well. Therefore, they're coming out very strong against deportation. Even with the president of the National Association for Evangelicals admitting that evangelical churches in Boston are now offering online services so their members don't have to gather together in one spot where the Trump administration might find out that the people there aren't here legally and could deport. So it's all phrased in very religious language, like we're all Christians, we shouldn't be deporting other Christians. The inference being that any Christian anywhere on earth is part of the body of Christ and therefore has a right to just come here to America, which is just not true. And I'm imagining many of our listeners know that this is just not true, that their Christians are called upon to obey the law of the land, the law of the country they're in. You can't just come from Guatemala to the United States without going through the proper channels. And so the underlying message of this document is really one of lawlessness, saying that, like, you don't need to obey the laws of the nation, you don't need to obey immigration laws, you have a right to be here. Something we've come to expect from the Roman Catholics Bishops' Conference. Now, this document breaks down the numbers and actually shows that about 18% of Roman Catholics in America, about one in five, are either here illegally or are related to someone who's here illegally and would be personally affected by Donald Trump's deportation policies. So the Bishops' Conference has for a long time been pushing this lawless idea that basically any of the world's 1.4 billion Catholics can come here if they want to, and we're going to hold online services so Donald Trump never finds out about it. What's new here is the support the National Association for Evangelicals is giving to the Roman Catholics Bishops' Conference, which is interesting, particularly for us on this program, because as our longtime listeners know, that here at the Philadelphia Trumpet, this is the successor work to the late Herbert W. Armstrong's Worldwide Church of God. When Mr. Armstrong died in 1986, his successors in the Worldwide Church of God turned away from everything he taught, started preaching a message that says we shouldn't be concerned with Bible prophecy, changed the name of the Worldwide Church of God to Grace Communion International, and then joined the National Association for Evangelicals. So the former Worldwide Church of God, it's one of those 45,000 churches represented in this umbrella evangelical organization working with the Roman Catholic Bishops' Conference to publish this document. The leader of the Worldwide Church of God, who actually led the effort to undermine Mr. Armstrong's legacy, Joe DeCotch, actually, as the president of Grace Communion International, signed a document in 2012, back during Barack Obama's first term. This document was put out by the National Association of Evangelicals condemning mass deportation. So he's been against this for at least 15 years. Now, Mr. DeCotch, he retired in 2019, and there's a new president for Grace Communion International now who's still following the same stance on immigration, but the fact that he's actually working with the Roman Catholic Bishops' Conference to make a document like this, opposing the Trump administration's policies, shows that church, they're even more against border enforcement than they were in 2012, even more pro-Catholic than they were in 2012. And really working together with the Roman Catholic Church to pressure the Trump administration to not deport illegal immigrants, which has some profound prophetic implications. You were talking just moments ago about this rising Holy Roman Empire, a Catholic-led Holy Roman Empire, which the Bible says in Deuteronomy 28, verse 52. This is one of the prophecies that Mr. Armstrong used to teach that Grace Communion International no longer teaches because they don't like the emphasis he put on Bible prophecy. But this Bible prophecy is saying that if America turns away from God, he'll send a nation from far away whose tongue you don't understand. They speak a different language than you. And he'll besiege you in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down. And Mr. Gerald Fleury has written numerous times before that this reference to your high and fenced walls coming down is specifically about illegal immigration. It's been a big curse on America for a long time. Now it's a curse on America being actively facilitated by the religion that dominates the Holy Roman Empire. And now even the very church Mr. Armstrong established has sided with this Holy Roman Empire against the Trump administration in an attempt to bring more and more illegals into the country. Yeah, so I think one of the resources we'll put in the show notes for today is a book our editor-in-chief wrote very early on in the PCG's history, back all the way in 1992, only about 3 years after he left the Worldwide Church of God, titled The Lion Has Roared. And this book, The Lion Has Roared, it's particularly about just how God's church needs to prophesy, like God gives us a commission to prophesy, with some strong criticism for those Christians who are saying prophesy not or don't get into these prophecies. That book, which I think many of our readers will find really interesting, it talks about an end-time religious leader in America who gains influence with the Jeroboam administration in order to suppress God's message. Now, since then, Mr. Fleury's identified Donald Trump as that Jeroboam figure. And since this false religious figure in Amos 7 is called Amaziah, a priest of Bethel, and Bethel is a Hebrew phrase meaning house for God or house of God, the strong prophetic indication is that this figure is actually a member a former member of the Worldwide Church of God. And so that's another reason it's important to watch stories like this, is that right now, all the leadership in Grace Communion International, or the former Worldwide Church of God, they said they're working closely with the Roman Catholic Church on this project, and actually opposing the Trump administration's policies. So they're not necessarily in league with the Trump administration at this point. Although this verse does indicate that, like I said, so someone from this former Worldwide Church of God, as they gain more political influence in the United States, will actually gain more influence with the Trump administration as well. And so definitely an important story for us to watch, how Grace Communion International and the Worldwide Church of God are talking about the immigration crisis, their partnership with the U.S. Bishops Conference, and maybe most importantly of all, how the Trump administration responds to documents like this. Indication that if you've got enough political support, the Trump administration may start taking more and more advice from religious groups like this going forward into the future. So that's one story I definitely wanted to bring to our listeners' attention that didn't have to do with Iran war. There's a few other stories that didn't have to do with the Iran war this week. One, still related to American border security, is the Trump administration still pushing hard for regime change in Cuba. They sent the first high-profile government delegation to Cuba since Barack Obama visited in 2016, telling the Cuban government that they're running out of time and need to urgently make free market economic reforms, strongly hinting that, like, if Cuba doesn't start making these changes, there could even be U.S. military action here in the near future. So this is another important story we watch, talking about like this Holy Roman Empire besiegement of the United States. Cuba was colonized by the Holy Roman Empire in historic times. It was guarded very important trade routes for the Holy Roman Empire in the Caribbean region. It was a huge battlefront between the U.S. and the Nazis in World War II. And Mr. Fleury, in one of his latest articles, Germany Turns the World Against America, talks about how a revived Holy Roman Empire is going to logistically need Latin American nations, including Cuba, to besiege the United States. And so Donald Trump is recognizing the threat posed by Cuba and taking action to neutralize it. But this is another frontline conflict between the United States and a rising Holy Roman Empire. We also had the president of Mexico coming out announcing an investigation into the fact that two U.S. Central Intelligence agents were recently killed in a drug bust in Mexico. Apparently, they were working with local state officials in Mexico to stop drug trafficking, but the Mexican federal government knew nothing about it. And since it's against Mexican law for foreign agents like the CIA to be doing operations like this without federal approval, it definitely represents diplomatic strains between the U.S. and Mexico. But more importantly, highlights just what a threat the drug trade is. The United States obviously knows it's illegal to send CIA agents into Mexico, according to Mexican law, but they're still willing to risk the diplomatic fallout due to the fact that the drug trade in Mexico is killing 23,000 people a year, and that violence is spilling into the United States. And so this is the Trump administration trying to use spy agencies to fix what's really a moral problem in America. millions of Americans are addicted to drugs. That's causing this drug crisis in Mexico, and America's having a harder and harder time finding ways to deal with it. And the last story, probably shouldn't be shocking, but was kind of shocking, is they've actually had a grand jury indicting the Southern Poverty Law Center for giving funding to the Ku Klux Klan and various neo-Nazi groups across America. Tremendous level of hypocrisy here. The Southern Poverty Law Center is a very radical leftist think tank that for years has published warnings about how the threat to America is right-wing extremism. And they justly criticize some pretty reprehensible groups like the Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazi groups in America, and then try to make it look like these groups are representative of the larger conservative movement. Definitely doing some hard core propaganda work for the radical left. And so now that they're showing that this group is actually funding some of the very groups they condemn, it's like job security for them. They're creating the problem that they're trying to fix. Because without groups like the Ku Klux Klan or these neo-Nazi groups, the Southern Poverty Law Center really has no reason to exist and no way to legitimately criticize conservative movements in America. So huge scandal here that this group in particular is actually funding some of the very groups they criticize. And there are going to be some pretty strong legal action, it looks like, going forward, just revealing a lot of the hypocrisy that has taken deep root in America, especially on the radical left.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew. I thought I'd also just take the chance to point to another couple of articles that we've had this week from Mr. Stephen Flurry. One is America Reads the Bible, But Will It Obey?, where we have seen American leaders all reading the Bible. I think they read the whole thing from cover to cover over the course of the week. So a book full of warnings, full of condemnation of the nation's sins, now read aloud. And Mr. Flurry has a lot more to say about that in that article and also on the Trumpet Daily Show. And then Mr. Flurry also wrote the main letter for the morning brief on April 21st, when a father becomes a predator, about the shooting in Louisiana where a man killed 8 of his own kids. Just a horrific, horrific crime against his own family, and a warning about, well, just the evil forces in America today and the evil that is abroad in the nation. So in their own separate ways, both stories, powerful calls to repentance and to return to God's protection and God's blessing. So we'll keep you up to date with all of those. Like I said, that was from the Trumpet Morning Brief, that article from Mr. Flurry, where we try and give you every morning a daily roundup of, all right, you're just waking up, or we probably get it out too late for it to be when you're just waking up. Maybe you sleep in. We do keep trying to get it out earlier. But anyway, what's new? What's happened today? What are the big stories? And we try to give you all of those in the Trumpet Morning Brief. You can subscribe to that on our website, thetrumpet.com. And we'd be very happy to get that out to you, add you to our mailing list. Well, thank you so much, Andrew. Thank you to all of our panelists. Thank you to George Haddad and Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. We will be back with our regular show on Wednesday next week. Until then, keep watching your world.